Well, hello, everybody. We're continuing on here in our series on the church or on our church. And unfortunately, this, which was recorded at the Citywide, or was supposed to be recorded at the Citywide, was not recorded at the Citywide. I forgot to hit the record button, which is a key to recording something, hitting the record button. And so as a result, I'm having to re-record the teaching here at home in this podcast series. As you know, we've been working through this series on the church, and specifically around our church, helping us and reminding us again about the uniqueness that is our church and where we came from and some of our history. And we felt this was important as a refresher and a reminder for many of us that have been with us since the very beginning. But also, we have a whole pile of people that are brand new to our church in these last number of years, and thought, you know, it's a good time just to tell these people too our story and who we are and where we came from and what things are important to us as a group of people and the values and the vision that God put in our heart. And so today we're going to continue on in that teaching, and today we are talking about money. Money, money, money. Why, you ask, in a series about the church or about our church, are we talking about money? Well, in order to answer the question, actually, we have to go way, 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 way back, all the way back to a guy named Moses. As you remember the story, or if you don't know the story, after the people of Israel, they were held in captive in Egypt, and Moses was raised up by God to help the people of Israel escape out of their slavery in Egypt. And in their escaping, they were led out into the desert, out into the Sinai desert. And there they wandered. They wandered there for 40 years before eventually entering into the land where they sit today as the nation of Israel. They were wandering in the desert. But it wasn't a waste of time, their wandering. In that wandering, actually, God used that season of time to help shape this people, to help form them into a nation. And as with any nation, in order to be formed as a people, you need some type of a constitution. Within that constitution, you need laws. And in some regard, that's exactly what God did with the people of Israel. He gave to them a law. Well, you might be familiar with the law, the Ten Commandments, sometimes it's referred to as. But actually, the law that God gave to Moses and to the people of Israel, which is recorded in the first five books of the Bible, there's a lot more than 10 laws identified there. In fact, the people of Israel understand that there were 613 different laws, 613 different guiding commands, things that formed them as a people. And this law covered all sorts of Israel's communal life together. It taught them how they were to worship. It taught them the things that they were to eat, those kinds of things, and how they were supposed to live in a way that set themselves apart from all the other nations around them. As you can imagine, though, the law also had a lot to say about money. Here's a few different things that the law taught to the people of Israel about money. In Exodus 22, God instructed the people that they were to loan to one another without collecting interest. In Leviticus chapter 19, a second law, and I love this one, it's so easy and tangible to get your head around, but God instructed that the edges of everyone's field, and remember it was a farmer or agrarian society, basically everybody farmed, but they said that the edges of everyone's field were not to be harvested. They were to leave the fruit there. Now, why was that the case? Well, it was so that those that had run into some type of trouble in that year, maybe somebody died, maybe somebody got injured, maybe they just couldn't work for whatever reason until their land, maybe their land didn't produce anything, whatever the case, those that had run into trouble could then come to that field that had not been fully harvested, and they could pick the wheat from that in order to feed themselves and feed their family until they could get their feet back underneath them. It's a beautiful, beautiful instruction that God gave to the people of Israel. And the third thing, something really radical talked about in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, The one thing was that the debts, people were to forgive each other debts every Sabbath year, every 7 years, all debts were to be forgiven. And every 50 years, which was called the Jubilee year, all land, all holdings was to be returned back to the original family members, and all slaves were to be set free so that those that had fallen on hard times would have a chance to start over. Now, let me unpack that, because that is really quite incredible and quite radical. The idea being that, you know, say for some reason you get in trouble, financial trouble. In order to get out of that trouble, you decide, you know, I need to sell an asset. And the asset that they had was land. And so they sold the asset to their neighbor. Well, that land was the primary way that someone could earn income for their family, but now they no longer had that asset. And you can see then in some way how this cycle of poverty would begin, because that person then, their children and their children's children also were without land and also without an ability to generate income. And so one side of the equation is getting richer and richer off accumulating more and more land, because the more money they get, then they can acquire more land. But the other party has no way of digging themselves out of that. And so the Jubilee year then was really this idea of being a reset. Let's set everything over again so that everybody has a fresh start and everybody has a chance to begin to develop income and take care of themselves, that there's no growing disparity. And of course, that's a key word there, and you understand how that works even in today's culture, how it's so difficult when someone finds themselves in poverty, it's so difficult to get out of that. It definitely becomes cyclical. Well, the Jubilee year was saying not for the people of Israel, we're going to have a reset every 50 years where everybody can start over. And the fourth law, which is maybe the most familiar of all of them, was that God instructed that a tenth of everyone's income was to be set aside. It was to be set aside and given to the temple. And the income, though, and this is key for us to understand, is that the income given to the temple wasn't just to be used for the priests, and it was allowed to be used for the priests, certainly, but actually, even more so, it was so that the priests in the temple then could redistribute those funds in the caring of the poor, and you see that in Deuteronomy chapter 14. And so the tenth and giving a tenth becomes a really key part of Israel's history, and certainly is something that the church itself has oftentimes adopted, this idea of saying we're going to give away 10% of all of our income in order to care for the temple, or in order to care for the church in our case, in order to care for the people that are poor around us. Now, when I gave this teaching at the Citywide, I set out 10 apples. And in order to visualize this, especially for the kids there, I said, what God's really saying here is he's saying, let's imagine that your income involves all of these 10 apples. Well, God's saying, you can live on 9 of the apples, but the 10th apple, I want you to take, and I want you to give it to the priest. And then I took a knife, and I said, now I want you to imagine that, say, you're a single mom, and I carved off a little of the apple, and I gave it to somebody. And you, oh, you broke your back, and you can't earn any income, so I gave you some of the apple and carved off a bit more. And another person, oh, you've gotten terribly sick this year, and so I carved off a little. And, oh, another person, oh, your husband died this year, and so it's very difficult for you to earn, and I carved off a bit more of the apple. And you see how I'm trying to demonstrate in this picture what it is to redistribute funds and redistribute income through this giving of the tenth. So in the law, God was shaping a people. And he was shaping a people specifically in this case who were to live differently from all the other nations around them as it related to their money and their possessions. This people, and here's the key word, were going to be a people who wouldn't live on everything that they had earned, but they were going to engage in the redistribution of wealth so that people had what they needed and so that the worship of God in the temple could continue on. And a very simple law that God gave to his people. Now, here's the big question. Do you think they actually lived by the law? And the evidence when you read through the rest of the Old Testament and the rest of the story of Israel is, well, frankly, not really. And the prophets of Israel who came onto the scene many hundreds of years after Moses, one of the biggest things that made them so angry as they spoke to Israel and as they wrote messages to Israel was frankly how greedy and how money-grubbing the people had become, especially the temple and the priests. How these people were getting richer and richer and richer. Does it sound familiar? And how they were not caring properly with their money. And so guys like Amos, again toward the end of the Old Testament, and Hosea and Isaiah, they all called people back to what God had asked his people. That was that they were to live differently with their money and differently with their land, caring for the poor, being careful not to defraud, being careful not to steal, but people didn't listen. One of the famous examples of this is from Amos. He writes this: "You levy a straw tax on the poor, and you impose tax on their grain. Therefore, though you have built your stone mansions from these things, you will not live in them. And though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink the wine. For I know how many your offenses are and how great is your sin. There are those who oppress the innocent and take bribes and deprive the poor of justice in the court. I despise your religious festivals, and your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me all of these burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Away with the noise of your songs." And then this famous verse that was used by the civil rights movement in the South in the 50s and 60s: "But let justice roll on like a river, and righteousness like a never-ending stream." That was Amos's word to the people of Israel. Like, you're coming and worshiping God with all of these things and offerings and sacrifices, and yet you are stealing from the poor. As a result of this, your worship is null and void to me. I'm not interested in it. Well, then along comes Jesus. And he, like all the other prophets before him, he sees the same thing. He sees the same thing that Isaiah and Amos and Hosea called, and like the other ones, it makes him angry. There's one famous story of Jesus visiting the temple, and I must say that there are many, many layers and symbolism, actually, to this story and what Jesus is doing in the story. But Jesus walks into the story, at least on a surface reading, he walks into the temple in this story. And he sees there how the priests and the temples and how this grand economy has been built, effectively subjugating through this economy these poor people that were coming to make sacrifices at the temple. And it makes Jesus absolutely furious. And so in the scene, he starts turning over the tables and starts crying out, "How dare you turn my father's house into a den of robbers?" He's so angry over this, that they would live so unfair. Like the prophets before, Jesus and the people that he was shaping around him, he was effectively just calling people back to what God had always asked of his people right from the very beginning, that they would simply be a people that lived generously, that lived fairly, that lived equitably, so that others would be cared for, that they wouldn't be driven to accumulate more and more and more for themselves while others spiral further and further and further into decay and into disparity, but there would be an equitability to these things. Well, the early church, when it was started, as Jesus launched these people that were following him, and then the Spirit came upon them, they took this message to heart. And in the Spirit's radical work in them, we read in the early book of Acts, the story of the early church, and we read in the letters of Paul and Peter and John, that these people were trying to live out in the Spirit's grace and power what God had always called the people to be about. They were trying to do this. They were trying to set aside a tenth of their money and these kinds of things. And actually, the early church then, writing back even outside of the scripture, had a lot to say in observation about what was really taking place. Here's a couple of examples. In 125, this Christian philosopher named Aristides, this is what he said about the early church. If they hear that any of their number is imprisoned or oppressed, all of them provide for his needs. And if there is among them a man that is poor and needy, and they've not had an abundance of necessary, they fast for 3 days, that they may supply the needy with their necessary food. Another example, in 150 AD, this guy, Justin the Martyr, he said this: the money thus collected is deposited with the president, which I'm assuming is some type of leader of the church. They referred to him as the president, and I think that would be a good title with which people could begin to refer to me as. I'm joking, by the way. The money thus collected is deposited with the president, who takes care of the orphans and the widows and those who are in straits because of sickness or any other cause, and those in prison and visitors from other parts. In short, he looks after all that are in need. In 200 AD, Tertullian, another early leader of the church, said, every person brings money whenever he wishes, and only if he's willing and able. It's a free will offering. You might call them the trust funds of the piety, and they are then spent on the support and the burial of the poor. You notice the emphasis of the use of money on the caring for people that are in need. And then there is the son of Constantine, the first emperor of Rome that converted to Christianity and began the Christianization, if you will, of the West. His son didn't follow in his footsteps, and he became known as Julian the Apostate, and he hated the church. But this is what he wrote about this church, observing about them. He said this in 330, those godless Galileans, I guess that's how we refer to the church, they feed not only their own poor, but also ours. That's quite the testament. Those godless Galileans, they feed not only their own poor, but ours also. You see, what's happening here is God's Spirit worked in that early church. They began to live out what God had always called his people to be about, this redistribution of the wealth. So that's a little history lesson about the early church and how it all functioned. So it shouldn't surprise us then, in 2005, when we started to pray about the birth of our own church, on the opening week, God started talking to us about money. Week number one, money was on God's heart. Here we are living in this very affluent community of Vancouver, become even more affluent, and actually the disparity has become even more increased in these last many years since the birth of our church. But God wanted to speak to us about money. I have this, you know, when we prayed together on those opening weeks and then talked and conversed about the things that we were praying about, I recorded those sessions and then transcribed the words after each session of prayer because I knew the things that we were praying about were important to us in the birth of our church. And so in preparation for this teaching, actually, I went back over the transcriptions of those evenings of prayer, and here's some of the things that we said out loud in that week one. Somebody said, I have a heavy one. God wanted me to write first of all about what he was happy about, but what made him sad came next as I prayed. He said, I'm completely grieved by the church. I don't like money playing such prominence in the church's life and dictating what dreams the church will have. Money is showing the church the way to popularity and comfort, things that I do not have in store for the church. Another person said, a scripture that I got when I was praying was that I did not share was Acts chapter 5, about how they held back money in that early church, and as a result, both them, Ananias and Sapphira, died. Another person said, when I asked what breaks the Lord's heart, he said to me, smelly people. What breaks my heart is that the church is not asking them to the banquet table. We're afraid of them, and we need to work through this. Another person said, well, a scripture that I got when I was praying was James chapter 1. The religion that the Lord accepts is to love the orphan and the widow. And in the weeks after that opening week, this similar message kept on repeat. And so when we began, we felt one of the fundamental building blocks is that we needed to live generously and that we needed to live simply. And the simple was so that we would have more to give away, to pour into the missions. This is one of the reasons why we decided to go into homes. It's one of the reasons why we decided we would have minimal staffing. It's one of the reasons why we call ourselves simple churches. It's the idea at the heart of us that we would be a people and a communal people, not just as individuals, but corporately as a church, that we would choose to live simply as a church so that we would have more to redistribute to people that are in need. We don't need a bunch of fancy things for ourselves. We just need to assemble together and love each other. But the more that we can give away, the better. And so as we shaped our early values, generosity, this value of generosity became one of the key founding values of our church. We said this about generosity. We said the Apostle Paul once said, though he, Jesus, was rich, for our sake he became poor. The very nature and mission of Christ involved an outpouring of generosity. He left the riches of heaven for the poverty of earth. Now, why did he do this? In order to be obedient to the Father and compassionate to the needy. We want to be people that live in this light. In a world of gaining more, we want to give more. In a culture of reckless consumerism, we determine to live simply. And why would we do this? In order to be obedient to the Father and compassionate to the needy. Jesus once said, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy. These, we declare, are words we will live by. I love that statement. That is so good. Well, so what happened since we began, right? Go back to the people of Israel and them being given their constitution, their law, and what happened to them? They didn't really live it out. So what happened with us? What has happened over these last 12 years? Well, the truth is that we've had our ups and we've had our downs. We've had years of success and years where we could have done better. One year, we gave 39% of all of our income away to people that were in need, which is pretty radical, given who we are. This past spring, though, as many of you know, we struggled. We were struggling financially. We were struggling with our budget. And as the leadership met, your council met, and we prayed about this and talked about this, we realized that at least some of why we were struggling was on us. And it was on us because we hadn't done a very good job of helping people understand this teaching that I'm giving here today. We hadn't helped people to understand this key part of our church and what we do with money and why we collect money and how even in our churches we give, especially new people that are a part of our church. We'd never really done a lot of teaching on this. And so in May of 2017, we wrote a letter, and we said this letter is going to go to every single person of our church as best as we could. And in that letter, we explained some of exactly what I'd just done here today, gave some of our history. And in it, we asked you then to join in. And the goal, we said, yes, we need to balance our budget because that's just good and prudent. But it was also that we could live out more fully this calling that God had placed on our heart, that we could live out this radical way. And in this teaching then, so I want to give a little update as to where we've come since May of 2017. First of all, the good news. And by the way, both these things are good news. But, you know, there are two ways that people give in our church. The one way is through pre-approved giving. And another way is through kind of one-time donations. People that are, you know, small business owners or whatever, and they don't get a regular paycheck. They oftentimes just send money into the treasurer or send money into to the accountant, and that's how that goes. Well, in May of 2017, our monthly pre-approved giving was at $4,580 a month, and there are many reasons why this had decreased. We had a number of people or key givers that had to move away or that could no longer give for various reasons. Whatever the case, we were a long way down where we needed to be. And we decided that part of the challenge before the church was that we wanted to raise that income to $7,000 a month. Do what we can. That's about, you know, $2,500 that we need to raise it by. Well, wouldn't you know, by December of 2017, we had done that. that monthly giving had gone from $4,580 to $7,375. That's an increase each month of $2,795. Annually, that moves us from $54,000 in pre-approved giving to $88,000 in pre-approved giving, which is an increase of $33,000. That's amazing and helps us live out our vision and be radical and caring for the poor and all that stuff. With so much more significance. And then that's just a part of it. We also said that we wanted to see our one-time donations. We needed to see our overall budget grow by $30,000. Do you know something? When we sent that letter out in May of 2017, by the end of May of 2017, we had already reached the $30,000 mark. There was $30,000 additional that came in May. And by the end of the year, we were at $40,540 in one-time donations. That's an increase in that year alone between pre-approved giving and one-time donations of $73,000. And I want to remind you, we are a small group of people. And I think that is amazing. I think it's a testimony of generous hearts and people that are saying, we want to live this way. We want to live in this way of sacrifice and of giving, and we want to live out this value. So here's the really good news then. What do we do with that? Well, one thing, obviously, we balanced our budget, and that was important. We needed to do that. There are things that bills that we just have to pay, and that's just the reality of our life. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. Some of the money when the people gave it in Israel was to be given for the care of the temple, and that's fair. But then from there, what did we do? Well, we started out with international partners, and we said, we want to give $10,000 away to people that are working around the world that we love and support. So we've longtime supporters of International China Concern and their care for the orphaned, disabled children of China. We gave $3,000 to them. We gave $4,000 to the Ukraine and the work that we and our church is engaged with there and caring for widows and orphans in the youth Ukraine. And we gave $3,000 to the Sharetskys, who are our partners in Germany. They've been flooded in these last many years with the care with refugees, and they're at hard at work loving people and caring for people in Germany. And so we supported them with that. And then we said, well, let's also give more locally. So we took $12,000, and I love this. We've done this on a few different occasions with our church, but we divided that $12,000, and at the time we had six churches, and we said, okay, every one of those churches, they get $2,000 to spend as they want. And we call it the big give leading up to Christmas. And you know, people started to give those, and almost all of that money was dispersed to specific people and families and single mothers in need. There was two gifts given to organizations. One gift was given to Reed, and another gift, I should clarify, Reed is for exploited women in Vancouver, and the other was for the Harvest Project, which was on the North Shore, which is poverty relief on the North Shore. But between those things, $22,000 given away to the poor and the needy around the world that we love and that we support. And that's just the start of things beyond balancing our budget. In a word, when I look at that, I just go, that's remarkable. I just love that. It makes me so grateful and so thankful to be a part of a church that's trying to live out this really wonderful vision of money, as opposed to getting more stuff and more things for ourselves. No, let's care for people. Let's love people through what we collect. And this is a big part of who we are as a church. And my prayer for us going forward in this year ahead and in the years ahead is that this would just be the tip of things for us, that more money might be given away, that more people might join into our ranks that see this vision and want to join into it, and that more people in Vancouver and around the world could be cared for, so that like Julian the Apostate, that people around our city and our friends and those looking in on us would be able to exclaim, those godless simple churchers, they feed not only their own poor, but also ours.